And the Annie E. Casey Foundation.
And you are listening to WMNF Tampa, Sarasota Clearwater Community Conscious Radio. Hi, I'm Mary Glennie.
And I'm Arlene Engelhart. And you are listening to From a Woman's Point of View. And of course, it's very interesting times, and we will continue to pursue them today. But I also want to remind you, I'm sure you've heard it on many other programs, that 2 weeks from today, we will be starting the fall fun drive, and we really do need your support. You can actually go ahead and give your support now if you'd like to, and it will count toward our goal. You just need to go to WMNF.org and click on programming, and then From a Woman's Point of View. We hope we'll hear from you. You can also contact us during the show that day, either on the web or by making a call. But please, we need to hear from you. We need to show the support for this show. And did you know that WMNF's main source of financial support is from listeners like you? The major portion of our funding comes through three pledge drives we hold each year. Our fall drive is October 4th through the 11th. But you can make a big difference now by going to WMNF.org and giving through this show's tip jar or by calling 813-238-8001 weekdays. Thanks for donating to the last local radio station in Tampa Bay. And support for WMNF also comes from our members and the Capitol Theater, presenting Roseanne Cash in her She Remembers Everything tour Friday, April 26th. At the Capitol Dot has more.
Well, Arlene, it looks like we're going to have to put on our boxing gloves and Ninja Warrior outfits so we all try and defend Dr. Christine Blakely Floyd. It looks like she's going to need all of us because, wow, particularly the white men, particularly the white Republican men on the Judicial Committee are giving her orders to march up, ma'am. It's his word versus your word. And so we're going to be discussing that today. Kind of sad, almost, you know, October 11th, I believe, 1991, when Anita Hill was subjected to, well, I don't know what to call that. And even she got FBI background checked. They did request that. So Dr. Ford is not even getting that much. And so without further ado, we are going to get into it because first we're going to be talking to Lenora M. Lapidus, and she is in charge of the Women's Rights Project with ACLU, and she's going to say how important it is that this is fairly done and well done. And then after that, we're going to be talking to Jessica Mason Piclo from WeWire.news, and she's going to be bringing us on the latest up to date. And if anything happens during this show, be sure and notify us because things are happening so fast that you don't know, your head is spinning. So I'm going to put this little music on by Julia Fairfield and Me Too, and then we will come back with Lenora Lapidus.
I'm tired of waiting, I've slowly been losing my patience. I'd like to inspire some change. We're trying to find our voice, hoping that someone will listen and hear us, so children don't have the same fate. We're fighting for something worth justice. We're fighting for a plague upon us.
Well, I'm going to pod this music down because I'm very happy to say we have been able to contact Lenora M. Lapidus, and she is actually in charge of the Women's Rights Project for the ACLU. Yes, that is the same position that the one and only RBG held, and she's really had just done some outstanding work that she has been involved with gender discrimination. She litigates gender discrimination cases in the courts throughout her country. They engage in public policy advocacy, speaks on gender equity, et cetera, and was actually very important. I've been involved with a lot of documentary films, I mean, in the sense of promoting them, et cetera, and I was very impressed with the work that the ACLU and you did with trying to get more women directors. So with all that in mind, Lenora M. Lapidus, welcome so much to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, I read your blog, and to me, it is so important because you do a very regular blog on the ACLU website, that how important it is right now that Dr. Christine Blakely Ford gets a just representation. And so let's go into this, because now in the time of Me Too, we're thinking back to almost about the same time period in 1991 with Anita Hill, and have we change much? Do you see much change? Because at least as I understand it, she's been given a deadline of 10 o'clock tomorrow morning that she is to present in writing what she intends to say, her comments on Monday, if she comes on Monday, and to have her ducks in a row. And so have we changed that much since Anita Hill?
Well, I certainly had hoped that we had. It's been 27 years since the Clarence Thomas hearings at which Anita Hill testified. That testimony really awakened the country to the fact of sexual harassment at work. It began a national conversation. And I think we have made progress in that quarter century in terms of people understanding more about sexual harassment and sexual assault. Certainly over the last year during the eruption of the Me Too movement, many more people have been coming forward and sharing their stories, and many more people who have been alleged to have sexually harassed or committed sexual assault have been held accountable. So it has seemed as though we were at a point finally of taking these issues seriously, of listening to women and of holding people accountable. And one would think that the Senate Judiciary Committee had learned something from 27 years ago and had learned that if a woman comes forward and makes an allegation, such as Dr. Ford has made here, that those charges would be taken seriously, that a full investigation would be conducted, and that a fair process would be undertaken to ferret out what are the facts, what do we know before an individual is confirmed to sit on the highest court in the land for a lifetime appointment. If Judge Kavanaugh is confirmed, he would sit on the Supreme Court possibly for the next 40 years. So this is a critical decision. It is not something that anyone has a right to. It is a very highly selective position. And before someone is granted that benefit, their entire background should be reviewed. And if there are questions, those should be thoroughly investigated.
And Lenora Lapidus, you know, let's go back, because actually sexual harassment was determined by the Supreme Court 5 years before 1991 with Anita Hill. But in a way that when people throughout the country watched those hearings, sexual harassment really came, the word, the sense of it came on people's consciousness, but not women. Women recognized in Anita Hill's story something that so many of them in different ways had been subjected to in their work. And even though there was a very tertiary, because what, it was like 2 days background, because at that time the Senate did order the FBI to continue their background check, so to speak, but 2 days later, and she was pillared. I mean, she was called erotic mania. She was said she was committing perjury, that it was really something to behold. And in a way, here we still have now, and this isn't sexual harassment, this is something far more serious, sexual assault, but it has continued. And if you will, with the present political circumstances, frankly, with a predator in the White House, if there's an explosion, you might say, of women saying, enough, we're not going to keep taking this. And so we have the Me Too, if you will. And so here we are, and we're watching the problems on college campuses, which have been really difficult, you know, that in a way, this we've been following this, you know, he said, she said, and how are you fair to both sides? And so it's not like this has been 20, you know, over those years in just a vacuum. But I think what's really troubling me, here you have the edicts, and here you have, you know, Grassley and others saying, and Orrin Hatch saying, well, the FBI doesn't do this kind of background check, when indeed they do. And so I'm looking at it, I'm comparing it to all the problems they have on college campuses and in the military, if you will. And here we see in the United States Senate the same kind of really unfair situation of he said, she said, and doesn't that trouble you a lot?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. I mean, we have certainly seen over the last several years much more information about sexual assault on college campuses. It happens in high schools, unfortunately, as well. And as you note, in the military, really in many, many different spaces in which women are sexually assaulted and taken advantage of, those stories are coming to light. There has been some accountability, but we are still far from changing the culture, which first of all says that sexual assault is not acceptable under any circumstances at any age. And secondly, that if sexual assault occurs, there will be consequences and people and institutions will be held accountable. And so for the Senate Judiciary Committee to not take a pause and undergo a thorough investigation of all of the facts, there are witnesses who could be interviewed here. There are records. It's come out already that there are Dr. Ford's therapist records from several years ago. There are facts and there is evidence that could be uncovered and that should be uncovered before these proceedings go any further. There is no need to rush. There is no deadline. And the Senate Judiciary Committee should ensure that a thorough investigation is conducted.
And again, we're talking to Lenora M. Lapidus, and she is in charge of the Women's Rights Project for the American Civil Liberties Union, or ACLU, a position with the great RBG held. And so it's a fond position, if you will. And Lenora, I think what's really troubling me is that you know, we know the difficult, and number one, this is not a criminal investigation. It's not being asked that the FBI, you know, do this as a criminal or a crime. It's being done as a background check. And more in just this very short time that we are getting a lot of information on the social, cultural milieu, if you might say, of Georgetown Prep and the kind of social activities that were done. And Judge Kavanaugh himself, you know, said what happens in Georgetown Prep stays in Georgetown Prep. But in the purpose of Judge Kavanaugh's evaluation, we want a sense of his character. We want a sense of, number one, I think under the milieu there, I think we'd want to know, you know, does he ever have a drinking problem, perhaps socially? I mean, in other words, all these things are coming into play with his character. And to me, to try and put her there with no attempt, you know, to get the whole sense of that time, is not just unfair, but to me, again, it underscores that this country seems incapable of understanding the seriousness of this problem and the regularity, the number of women that have a very, and maybe we should go into that real briefly, that actually, you know, Dr. Ford struggled with what happened to her and how long it took it to come out, but how it affected her life, that the guy goes on, but the woman has to deal with it. it's deep in her subconscious, and it is with her all of her life. This is not a serious crime.
Yeah, let me first address the first point you made, which is about the investigation. You know, folks should keep in mind that the Senate has a constitutional obligation to provide its advice and consent on any nomination to the Supreme Court. That is a constitutional responsibility. That means the Senate, before confirming any nominee, needs to know all of the information about that candidate's background. And certainly here, for them even to be able to question the witnesses, they need to have the background investigation and report that tells them the different facts and the different evidence from which they can then ask questions. A hearing is not the first time that facts and evidence should come out. When the senators are questioning the nominee, they've got background information already gathered. So that's the investigation we're talking about, that would pull together all of the facts and evidence from which the senators then can ask questions and complete their job, both at the Senate Judiciary Committee and then for the full Senate to vote. The second point that you raise about the seriousness of sexual assault, that is absolutely right. You know, I think this country is beginning to come to terms with the prevalence. The Me Too movement has done really an incredible job of opening people's eyes to the widespread sexual violence, sexual harassment, sexual discrimination, frankly, that women and girls face in this country. But there are still people who are saying, oh, this happened, you know, back when they were teenagers, and dismissing the seriousness of it. As you
well,
say,
and dismissing the seriousness to the man, the boy.
Yeah.
They aren't even dealing with the seriousness to the young woman.
Exactly. And as you say, someone who has suffered a sexual assault, that does stay with her for her entire life. Dr. Ford has spoken about that. Many survivors of sexual assault, of attempted rape, have spoken about how that incident has really, you know, colored their entire future life in terms of difficulties with relationships, in terms of difficulties with self-esteem. It is a huge traumatic event that needs to be understood better. And certainly the way the Senate Judiciary Committee is operating right now, of not doing the investigation that should be done, of rushing things forward, and of really demanding that Dr. Ford come and testify on Monday without taking into consideration how this trauma may have impacted her, is really inexcusable.
And I think it's the fury of women. And frankly, I'm furious. I really am. I mean, this isn't anything new. As I have said, we have been dealing, you know, with sexual harassment in schools, in the military, et cetera, in the workplace. And I know you're ACLU, that you've got a 12 for 12 this year, don't you? In which you're dealing with discrimination of women. And you know, first it was immigrants, but you also have digital, but you also have, you know, at the workplace, all of that. And we know that it is there. And to me, we're talking about the United States Senate. This is a teaching moment, if you will. And I think that they have to realize, whoa, this is what Me Too is about. That, you know, this is, you know, and it's slippery ground. There isn't any easy way to do with this, he said, she said, unless you do fill out the whole picture you bring in. And maybe it's uncomfortable for some people, particularly if you're a white male senator, that think that, you know, that actually in the hullabaloo of this, you know, that they're, well, you know, boys will be boys. Just that attitude starts that this should not mark this young man for his lifetime, and that there is not a sense of what's happening to this young woman. And to me, this is a teaching moment. It's really important that the United States Senate shows that it gets it. And it says, huh, how do we deal with this problem? And really steps back from a very arbitrary deadline that they're trying to impose and realize this is what's happening in women's lives, in young girls' life, and it has been, and it is right there staring us in the face. And that I really think the women in this country should really take to the streets and say, whoa, this is what we're talking about. Get it. Or I think, as Maisie Hinono said from Hawaii, get out of the way if you don't get it.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right to link this to the much broader issue of ongoing, persistent gender discrimination. As you mentioned, the ACLU has a 12 months, 12 faces of gender discrimination initiative right now, where every month we are highlighting another form of gender discrimination. And really, sexual assault and sexual harassment and the ways in which institutions respond to that is part of the broader problem of the role of women in society today. Women are still treated as second-class citizens. Women's voices are still silenced. They are not taken seriously, not only when they make allegations of sexual assault or sexual harassment, but when they speak up at work, when they speak up in classes. And so long as women are not treated as fully equal, with equal pay, with equal positions of power, imagine if the whole Senate Judiciary Committee were women, committed to gender equality. Just envision how different this moment would be. So we have a very long way to go in terms of women's full equality in this country. And in order to get there, when we have a situation like this, where an allegation, a serious allegation of sexual assault has been made, the institutions, in this case, the Senate, must take those allegations seriously, must accord women equal treatment in valuing what they have to say. And only in that way can we proceed and can people feel like the Senate is operating in a fair way and that whoever makes up the court, makes it up and will represent fairly any issues that come before it. So it's critical for sort of the public to have confidence in our institutions, including Congress and the courts. In order for the public to have that kind of confidence, those institutions must operate in a fair way that treats women's concerns seriously.
Well, Lenora M. Lapidus, the head of the Women's Rights Project for the American Civil Liberties Union, I really want to thank you for all the work you do, your wonderful blogs. I really spent some time reading your blogs last night, and I think they're very, very well written and very much to a very good point. And so thank you so much for giving us this time today. I really do appreciate it.
Well, thank you so much for having me, and anyone else who would like to read those blogs can go to aclu.org. I'd be happy to share those more broadly with the public. So thank you so much for having me.
Thank you. You do take care.
Bye-bye.
And Arlene, do you have something you want to say?
I just posted her most recent blog on Kavanaugh on our Facebook page, as well as on From a Woman's Point of View on my Facebook page and Bulletin Board WMNF.
Okay, well, I'm going to real quickly play this, so I'm going to get the station biz, and then I'm going to come back because the next guest is really under a time frame, and so let's listen to this.
NF Community Announcement. Superheroes are fun to watch at the movies. However, there are almost 1,000 abused and neglected children in Pasco and Pinellas counties waiting for real-life superheroes to volunteer as guardians ad litem and become their voices. These precious children need volunteers to help them find safe, permanent homes. Guardian ad litem volunteers become superheroes to our community's children. You may learn more at herotoachild.org.
And you are listening to WMNF Tampa, Sarasota Clearwater Community Conscious Radio. Let's go to this music and we will come back with our next guest.
Tired of waiting, I've slowly been losing my patience, I'd like to inspire some change. We're trying. trying to find our voice, hoping that someone will listen and hear us. So children don't have the same fate. We're fighting for something worth justice. We're fighting for a plague upon us. The plague.
I'm going to pod this down by Juliet Fairfield, me too, because I'm so happy the next guest we have with us in a very busy schedule, and I'm really so grateful, Jessica Mason Piccolo, the Law and Public Policy for Rewire.News, that just superb website that gives just fabulous information. And so, Jessica Mason Piccolo, welcome back. I can't believe we're still talking about Judge Kavanaugh. It just keeps out by dribbles and dribbles. I'm kind of understanding why they don't want all those papers to be shown, don't you?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, first of all, thank you again, Mary, for having me. It's always so great to be on your show. And this is really sort of a double-edged sword, isn't it? On the one hand, the fact that we're still talking about Kavanaugh means his nomination hasn't advanced quite as quickly as Republicans had hoped it would, but at the same time, what we are talking about is certainly upsetting, to say the least.
Yeah, and you know, I was just talking to Lenora M. Lapidus, and she's Women's Rights Project with the ACLU, and you know that yes, the Women's Rights Project, you know, the one with RBG, the infamous RBG, mm-hmm. you know, and you know, we were just talking, and you know, it's the Me Too movement, if you will, the explosion, mm-hmm. but it's also sexual harassment, and you know, we're comparing, and tell me, the latest I have heard is that Grassley has given her a moratorium that she's got to get it in by 10 o'clock tomorrow morning. I guess she's got to get what she's going to say and her background information. And as I understand it, she's been harassed so much with threats and all kinds to her family, her husband. So they've had to go into hiding. And this to me is kind of amazing, but at least that's the last I've heard.
Yeah, that's a pretty good synopsis. So, you know, the allegations came out. Dr. Ford came forward, and the Republicans initially had insisted that the Kavanaugh nomination was going to proceed as originally scheduled, which would have been for a committee vote today. Then Senator Grassley said, I think at the after some pressure from some other members of the Republican Senate to hold a hearing, but this is really a sham hearing, the more we're learning about it, and have really refused to work with Dr. Ford and her attorney for any sort of fair process. And evidence of that are these deadlines that they're putting up. You know, Grassley wants the hearing to happen on Monday so that the committee can probably get a vote in for Kavanaugh's nomination by the end of this week and then a full Senate vote. So maybe he's not on the bench, presuming he were to be confirmed by the very beginning of October, which is when the Supreme Court term starts, but definitely still before the November midterm elections, which is what Republicans are really worried about. And so, you know, everything is happening on this accelerated timeline because Republicans are really trying to get this seat filled before the midterm elections, and the possibility that Democrats could have the opportunity to block the nomination the way Republicans did that of Merrick Garland.
Do you think, Jessica, it has anything to do with Kavanaugh's views on the imperial presidency, that he's an unindicted co-conspirator in this, and we know that this is going to push to shove, probably come to the Supreme Court? You don't think that has anything to do with his hurry, hurry up, do you?
I mean, I think it definitely, we definitely have to ask that question. I, you know, because the choice for Kavanaugh, when there are so many other candidates who share his radically conservative views, but don't seem to have quite the paper trail and, you know, at this point, the kind of very serious allegations of attempted rape now that the Republicans are trying to manage. There are a lot of questions as to why he hasn't withdrawn his nomination, why President Trump hasn't withdrawn his nomination, because the reality is Democrats don't have the numbers to block a nominee. Republicans can basically put anyone on the court they want, unless that someone is so terrible that they can't even get through Republicans, and that might be the case with Kavanaugh. So I think it's very smart to ask the question of what's motivating this nomination and the manner in which Republicans are proceeding. And so I think consolidation of power in the judiciary is one part of it. And then I think, you know, the idea that Kavanaugh has signaled that he will be a friendly vote for this administration on issues of executive power and immunity is certainly another possibility.
And, you know, we've gone through, particularly I've gone through with you and some others, the legal reasons, you know, not the least of which is perhaps committing perjury in both 2004, 2006, and again in these hearings, and his involvement in, number one, in political aspects with Bush, way back with Starr, and impeachment of President Clinton, et cetera. And we might quickly review those, but I want to go right now to the milieu, if you will. And you look at a Brett Kavanaugh, and you see a person that was on the career path, so to speak, from the get-go. And here he is at this exclusive boys' Catholic school. And, you know, looking and reading from Mark Judge, I haven't read the book, but I've read parts of it. And I guess, and I'm bringing it to the Me Too, and you know, that you look at this, and you look at the fallout from the people that have been called out, you know, and in the Me Too movement, you know, and the powerful positions they are. And I think, to me, the most disgusting thing is that you realize that, frankly, it's mainly white, patriarchal, but a milieu of privilege, a milieu that they can do and will get by with anything. And to me, it's kind of come front and center to me with now this assault charge on Kavanaugh. Do you feel this, that everything about this has really been very distasteful? And I don't mean just now the assault. I also mean the fact that they haven't discussed Judge Kuczynski. You know, did he get those emails? You know, was they've been involved? He knew him very well. And if they knew about this, why didn't they do anything? I mean, obviously it was so well known that this man was such a predator, but he was seen in this white privileged position that, you know, he's a real liberal. And so, you know, don't take his views seriously. He doesn't mean anything bad. But to me, this is part of this whole network, this kind of sense of white male privilege, which, frankly, I think is poisoning the morality of this country.
Yeah, so there's a lot of things going on here. You know, when I was covering the confirmation hearings before the Senate Judiciary Committee, I talked about this as a pipeline of power, where those who have sort of access and are adjacent to it really do everything they can to keep themselves and their children and their children's children within that pipeline. I think that's why we saw, for example, that letter come out with 65, you know, former high school colleagues of Brett Kavanaugh's that said effectively, he's a really good guy because he didn't try to rape me. So that is absolutely about the sense of privilege and power protecting itself. And that is absolutely entrenched in this sort of white male patriarchy. I think it's worth noting that there are a lot of white women in that group that are propping this up as well, because as we've talked about, you know, on this show in the past, white women who are adjacent to these pipelines of power benefit from this more than they do sort of hurt themselves individually. So while the rest of us may feel the brunt of a Kavanaugh on the court when and if the court were to overturn Roe, for example, those women who've been defending him likely have no skin in the game, so to speak. So there's that. And then, of course, there is, you know, just the whole issue of Republicans trying to frame Dr. Ford's allegations as an ambush, as an 11th hour attack. And there's no 11th hour attack. The only reason we're even talking about an 11th hour is because of the fact that Charles Grassley has put this artificial timeline on the process that is just fed up on steroids. And, you know, they have sort of pivoted this to trying to question Senator Feinstein and other Democrats who had access to Ford's allegations. And I think it's just really important to note that Dr. Ford's attorney has said that Senator Feinstein handled this properly. Dr. Ford was trying to figure out how and when and if she came forward for months. And as we know, talking about, you know, the Me Too movement, for every brave woman who comes forward, there are 5, 10, 15 brave women who can't. And so that, I think, has to be part of this conversation, too, is Feinstein feeling this obligation to respect Dr. Ford's privacy and wishes to tell her story on her own terms. And Republicans are now, you know, even in this framing of trying to hear her out and get to some facts of these allegations, actually doing the opposite and making that impossible.
And again, we're talking to Jessica Mason Piclo, and she is in charge of law and public courts for Rewire.News. That's just excellent website. I really strongly recommend you go to it. You'll just get wonderful, very, very intellectual and very researched information. And Jessica, tell me, what do you think of what's happening with Senator Collins? Are you a bit disappointed, or what do you think about her reaction?
Oh, I mean, I'm not surprised at all. Senator Collins has proven herself to be quite willing to roll over when necessary and fall in line for Republican causes. And she's very much signaled throughout this process that her mind is made up on Brett Kavanaugh, that she intends to vote for the nomination. And I think, you know, for a minute there, folks had some hope from Senator Jeff Flake as well, who had said, and he's a member of the Judiciary Committee, that he would not be able to vote on the Kavanaugh nomination until there was a hearing. And he's now taken the position of, well, Republicans have offered Dr. Ford this opportunity to be, you know, ambushed on live television while, you know, Brett Kavanaugh has had the opportunity to be prepped here by Bill Shein, for example, since the allegations have come out. That's what he's been doing. Is it basically in debate prep. And so now Jeff Flake has said, you know, well, we've offered her a spot, and if she doesn't testify, then we still move forward and we vote for Kavanaugh. So, you know, the Republicans have made it clear that they are doing this as a formality, that there is no good faith effort to try and do their constitutional duty. And, you know, I would just remind listeners that this isn't about proving the allegations against Kavanaugh true. This isn't a criminal trial. What the Senate is tasked by the Constitution to do is its advice and consent duty as to whether or not Brett Kavanaugh has the proper temperament to a lifetime appointment on the federal court. So it's not, you know, this was he young and made a mistake, which is exclusively the domain of white men, as we've seen in this country. But how did he handle that as an adult and as a candidate, most importantly, for the Supreme Court? Has he lied about it? You know, these are very real perjury questions, which is why you see also the Republicans putting on basically a charade here.
Yeah, totally. And you mentioned Senator Flake. I find with a lot of these people, and I think he's named appropriately, that they speak they speak loudly, but they vote softly.
Yeah.
I find they do not put their money where their mouth is. But going back, and you know, you were talking about the advice, you know, and consent. That's what the Senate has to do. Well, to me, it also is deeper than that. Really, this to me, the Me Too movement, like Dr. or Lapidus and I were talking about that, you know, that this is an explosion of frustration with women. And here the U.S. Senate is not just advising and consenting, you might say, about the merits of this man, because as you said, the FBI background investigation would not be to determine his criminology or, you know, the actual facts of this case in that sense, but only the facts in the case to give them better chance to interview, etc. And, you know, with the Me Too movement, that women are so aware of sexual harassment and sexual assaults, if you will, in the workplace, in the military, you name it. And it's a very serious problem. And I'm sure the Senate didn't want to have it right there in their doorstep, but they do.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, really, I think we should really focus the light on, because they are facing, again, the same problems that schools and the military have. He said, she said. And now this is, and this is a, you can't just anymore, you know, even though Hatch, you know, I said, well, this, you know, Dr. Ford is just confused that she has the wrong guy, you know, and here is a psychologist who works, you know, at Palo Alto, but also she's with the Stanford Consortium, and they're training graduate students in psychology how to do interviews. I mean, this is not a mixed up, screwed woman. And to me, Jessica, that, you know, the Senate in its closed, you might say, D.C. environment is facing the real world of Me Too. And the same way, you know, do they have the qualities to really try? And anyway, what are they going to come to terms with? Are they going to examine his character? Are they going to say, well, did you guys party and drink a lot? And sometimes you did blackouts, you know, almost alcoholic blackouts, you know? I mean, could this have happened? That's not the attitude they're taking. They're going to try and get Dr. Ford, you know, to totally implicate her as being crazy or, you know, mixed up, confused and all of this. And this is a problem that in the rest of the country is having all over. And to me, the Senate needs to deal with it. And do they have the competence? And they have to be clear. What are they doing here? And to me, I'm seeing this, Jessica, as really a huge underlying factor that I think particularly women have to really start screaming about, because this is so important.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, there have been very rightly a lot of parallels made to the ways in which the Senate treated Professor Anita Hill when she came forward with her allegations against Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas. And I think as in terms of the manner in which we talk about the Anita Hill trial, right, as opposed to the Clarence Thomas confirmation hearings, that was absolutely the country via the Senate putting Anita Hill on trial right there. I do think that we have one, possibly two real distinct differences that work in the favor of the Me Too movement and the favor of survivors seeking justice, and that is the composition of the Senate Judiciary Committee from the Democrats' perspective. Unlike the Anita Hill hearings, not only do we have women on the Democratic side of the dais, but we also have some very seasoned prosecutors in the form of Senator Kamala Harris and Senator Amy Klobuchar. And then we have the absolute lion of an advocate in Senator Mazie Hirono. And, you know, those are just, that's not even mentioning Ranking Member Dianne Feinstein. So that is going to make a difference in the manner in which Kavanaugh is treated and the manner in which Ford, to the extent that she does or does not participate with whatever happens on Monday, is either treated or discussed. And so I think that, you know, this is a real moment for the women leaders in the Senate to shine through. And it will be a very important lesson for the country as to what we mean when we say that representation matters. It will matter to have women on the Senate side questioning Kavanaugh about this, because that was something that just did not happen with Clarence Thomas.
And tell me, I've read and heard many times that people are saying that the Republicans are hoping she won't testify. And do you feel that's the case? And what do you feel if she says that I want a background check, where actually she has everything to lose, if you will? I mean, in other words, when do you have a person making a charge and she wants the FBI to investigate it? But do you think she will testify?
Well, I think her attorney is doing absolutely the right thing by her client, Dr. Ford, in demanding to be a part of the process and determining how this testimony will happen. This is actually the normal way that these kinds of situations happen, whether it's congressional testimony or if you are in, you know, a private mediation or litigation posture, that there is negotiation about the terms of the interview, right? We see the president himself doing this with Mueller on the Russia probe. Like, this is normal. The only thing that's not normal about it is Senate Judiciary Republicans insisting that there's no negotiation that can happen. So if that's the play that the Republicans keep making, I think it is very well within her rights and reasonable for her to refuse to participate. And you're absolutely right. She has everything to lose by bringing in the FBI on this. It is a serious, serious crime to make a false allegation. And so people who make false allegations don't tend to invite the FBI in to dig around in those things. So, I think that's an important part. I think the fact that Republicans will move forward with this hearing, whether Ford participates or not, is also a signal to the American public and specifically to women, because these are all men making this decision. That this is Senate Republicans and the entire Republican Party telling women they are not interested in their truth. They are not interested in their stories, that they will, when they need to, and which is always, protect abusers. And not just protect them, but promote them.
And again, we're talking to Jessica Mason Piclo, and she is Law and Public Policy for Rewire.news. Jessica, they're with Anita Hill. There were actually three women waiting outside the door that they wanted to testify to with their experiences with Clarence Thomas, and they weren't allowed to testify. And we think of the court with a Clarence Thomas and some of the decisions he has made. And to tell you the truth, with he and Neil Gorsuch and Alito and Roberts, and if Kavanaugh joined them, I think we haven't seen anything yet of the kind of decisions that might just come out. And doesn't this trouble you, really, that because I've heard other people now saying, well, we've got to change the way the Supreme Court, is the lifetime appointment and et cetera. I mean, are you seeing this kind of a whole situation where it's kind of being rammed down, and you have a majority on that Senate committee that is denying all of these records, all of these notes, et cetera, that which are so important to determine, obviously, the character and the thinking of this man? That do you really feel there are some needs to make some changes in how the Supreme Court is chosen, but even more importantly, a lifetime appointment?
The lifetime appointment issue is really interesting because I'm of two minds of it, quite frankly. On the one hand, it is quite frankly terrifying to me that we have justices like Neil Gorsuch and potentially Brett Kavanaugh who, relatively speaking, are young by Supreme Court appointment standards and stand to be on the bench for 40 years, for example, right? They can do a lot of damage in that time. And so the idea of term limits is sort of initially appealing, but what it doesn't get to and what I struggle with is the fact that we could remove justices, say you're only allowed to serve 10 years or 15 years or whatever. But in that time, their legal opinions don't unwind when they leave the bench. And so I don't know that fixing lifetime appointments gets to the very partisan deadlock that we have happening with the Supreme Court right now. Similarly, I don't know if the idea of adding more justices, which is something that I've heard floated, like should Democrats do very well in the midterm elections or in 2020 and have unified control the way Republicans have, they could pass legislation that would put more justices on the bench. There's nothing in the Constitution that says we have to have nine. That is interesting and, certainly a possibility and something that we've talked about before. Again, I don't know if that fixes the problem of the fact that the court, which has always historically been a political institution, is now more than ever a partisan institution.
Yeah, we look at the training, particularly of the Federalist Society, and we look at a Kavanaugh or a Gorsuch, and we look at the training from the get-go, if you will. He goes to a very exclusive Georgetown prep, goes to Harvard, goes to all the best schools, et cetera. And frankly, then we watch the whole progression of his thinking. And I respect people's thinking, et cetera, but in some cases, I kind of wonder, when you see the kind of consistency with Gorsuch and a Kavanaugh, that you kind of wonder, that is this ideologically driven as opposed to really that individual with his legal, a human, really in his own heart of hearts deciding, is this the best, you know, result? And Arlene, I know you really want to say something, so go ahead.
Well, I've got a question for Jessica from one of our listeners, wondering what it takes to have a quorum in the Senate, and if all of the Democrats walked out and refused to participate in the vote, would that put them in a position where they did not have a quorum and consequently stop the vote?
Oh, hi, Arlene. Thank you for the question. I love this idea. I have been yelling about this forever. So the idea that the Democrats could, as I call it, pull a Wisconsin, which is what Wisconsin Senate Democrats did in the state in 2011 when Governor Scott Walker was ramming down his anti-union agenda. They left the state. they forced the sergeant-at-arms to haul them back in for a vote. And so I think that that is a possibility that Democrats should look very seriously here. So the issue that we're facing is that Kavanaugh only needs a majority vote in the Senate to confirm him. And by the numbers, he has a majority. So we know that John Kyle is taking McCain's seat. And so exactly when all of the votes line up, if Democrats hold together, and that is a big if, Claire McCaskill came out yesterday and said that she's voting against the Kavanaugh nomination, which is good. She did that before Monday, but we have many Democrats who have been waffling, like Heidi Heitkamp, for example, from North Dakota.
And Bill Nelson from Florida.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and Bill Nelson and Joe Manchin and the usual suspects. So this is a great short-term strategy to gum up the works. It's not a long-term strategy to defeat the nomination, but it could work in tangent to draw the nomination out past November, which could raise some interesting possibilities of, you know, what happens if the Democrats take control of the Senate and then do have the numbers to block a nominee. So another thing that I think is valuable about the idea of denying a quorum is that even if they don't have the numbers and Republicans still have everybody in, you know, they haul in Vice President Pence if they need him because of to get to 51 votes. If that's the case, then the optics of it at least are very bad for Republicans also. They own this nomination and confirmation 100% at that point. And I think that's a powerful electoral message. It doesn't do us any good because Kavanaugh's on the bench, you know, in that sense. But I do think that we have to also be looking forward in terms of, you know, what we do if he's confirmed and how we rally and move forward from that. Because while it is, it would be a catastrophic shift to the right for the court at the same time, as I've said on this show, I know a couple times, the court has historically always been very conservative. And we have one blip of moment in history when it wasn't during, you know, the Brennan and the Warren years. And other than that, you know, the Supreme Court is the body that gave us separate but equal, for example, you know, that has said that, you know, dollars are speech in terms of political spending in ways that really tilt the balance of power to the rich in electoral ways that we're feeling the effects of. So, you know, history continues on, but I do think the idea of denying Republicans a quorum is one that Democrats, I hope, are considering.
And as if I understood what you were saying correctly, they could still go ahead and vote, and it would be a legal vote if all 51 voted to confirm Kavanaugh. Is that correct?
Yes, that's correct. You know, the real problem for Democrats has always been the fact that we just don't have the numbers in the Senate to block anything. We faced some real tough losses in the Senate, and so, you know, focusing on regaining seats in the House in 2018 is extremely important because, as we know, that's where impeachment proceedings begin. And without numbers in the House, there's no reason to think that congressional Republicans are going to do anything to move on reigning in President Trump in any way. And when it comes to reigning in the president via his nominations, the Senate is the only place that we can do that, and we really need those numbers, and right now we don't have them. But there is the possibility that some, you know, senators like, you know, I don't think it would be Collins, but perhaps Murkowski, who is facing a lot of constituent pressure right now, would not feel comfortable with the optics of the Republican Party voting lockstep with each other to advance the nomination and put on the bench for life.
And Jessica, I hate to intervene here, but we literally have run out of time. I really want to thank you so much, Jessica Mason Piclo, a law and legal policy for Rewire.news. And you have been listening to WMNF Tampa, Sarasota, Clearwater, Community Conscious Radio. Thanks so much to all of you. Just keep listening.
And we've had listeners call and say, please, you stand up, insist on an FBI investigation, call your senators, and particularly Senator Nelson, since he hasn't announced his vote yet. You can reach them all at 202-224-2121.
Okay, let's go out with this.
To live in